Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Mem Dalet Amud Aleph at the two dots. Shtein av lamala, shtein av lamata. Ma shtein av lamala, u shtein av lamata. What does it mean that both eyes are above, or both eyes are below? Ilema shtein av lamala, dechazi lamala, that both eyes being up means that they are constantly looking upwards or projected upwards. Shtein av lamata, dechazi lamata, that they're always looking down or projected down. Eno achat damala veeno achat damato. The chazai eno achat damato veeno achat damalo. One of the eyes either sees or appears upwards and one appears downwards or sees downwards. Then the problem is that the next line in the Mishnah is, hainu ro'e techeder v'taliya ke'achat. That's the next line in the Mishnah, which is that your cross-eyed, or here, one eye goes up and one eye goes down. So then the two lines in the Mishnah are identical. So then it doesn't differentiate them in any way. Ella. Shtein av lamala, dekaimon lamala. So shtein av lamala is not about where you're looking or the appearance of the eye, but rather the location of the eye. It is above the normal placement on the face. They're up higher up. Shtein av lamato, dekaimon lamato. Two eyes below means that they're lower down than when your standard location on the face, so where your eyes would appear. Eno achat lamala, veino achat lamato. Dekaimon eno achat lamala, veino achat lamato. One eye is above the normal location, one eye is below the normal location. V'kaime kisidra nami. Even if they are in the normal placement, they are in the regular place. V'ro'et acheder v'taliya k'achat. But the eyes themselves, one looks upward, one looks down, in that they're not coordinated or correlated, and one's always up and down, or they appear up and down, that's also problematic. So it means that the statement in the Mishnah, the malo namato, in the first part of the Mishnah, we're all talking about the location of the eyes, their placement on the face. Cheder and Aliyah is a description if the eyes are in place, but the functioning of the eyes is not normal because one eye goes up, one eye goes down. Menahane Milay, how do we know that that is a problem? Because the Pasuk by the Mumim of Adam in Parshat Emor in Perek Chaf Aleph says, Kichol ish asher bo mum lo yigrav. Ish iver o piseach o charum o sarua. So here we have ish iver, which is going to become important in a second. O ish asher yeb o shever rogel o shever yad. O gibain o dak o tibvalul be'eino. O garab o yalefet o meroach hashech. So with regards to eyes, you have three different mumim that are mentioned here. You have an ish iver, and then you have dak, and then you have tavlul be'eino. Those are the mumim that are mentioned by the eyes. And here the Gemara says, Menane Milay, that these items that we mentioned in the Mishnah are disqualifying, are mumim that are problematic. The Tanu Banan, Be'eino. It says there, Dak v'tavlul Be'eino. Ko mashe Be'eino. The word Be'eino comes to teach you that any eye problem is also a disqualifying factor, because you don't need the word Be'eino. Could have just written Dak and Tavlul, and you would have known they reference to the eyes. Those are mumim of the eyes. Why did it mention be'eino? To teach you that any improper placement or mum in the eye will also be a disqualifying factor. Mikan amru. From here they have, shtein av lamata, shtein av lamala, eino achat lamala, eino achat lamata, ro'e techer v'taliyah v'kachat. O, shemidaberim chavero, and if he's speaking to his friend, ve'acher omer li ro'e. And the other one says he's looking at me. So again, that's maybe a cross-eyed version again, where the person, you think they're looking, speaking to you, but one of the eyes or the eyes themselves are wandering away, looking in another direction. All of those are subsumed under the be'eino. Tanu Rabbanan, iver. So the other thing we discussed with the eye was an iver. Ben suma b'shteinav, ben suma b'echat meinav. Whether he's blind in both eyes or only blind in one eye, that's covered by iver. Chavarvar v'amayim akvuim minayin. So we already mentioned these in the previous perek, where you have the chavarvar and the mayim akvuim, which are things that cause problems with the vision of the individual. If they are kvuim, then they are a mum. If they're not kvuim, then they're not a mum. Obviously, they're a mum over at that time, but they will cure themselves. How do I know that those are also problematic? Tamalomar ish iver. Doesn't just say iver, it says ish iver. Amarova, lamali dichtav rachmana. Ish iver dak tevalul be'eino. He's asking, I have all these different eye ailments. Why do I need you to tell me each one of them? If you told me one of them, I should be able to figure out that anything wrong with the eye is problematic. What's the difference between each one of them? He says, Tzrichei, we need them. Gitka gav rachmana iver. Had the Torah only written the word iver, mishom deletnehu klau. Because he doesn't have eyes at all. The meaning, or the true meaning of the word iver, is a lack of eye. I mean, it's not just simply an inability to see. Iver means that the person lacks the actual physical eye in order to be able to see. So you would have thought if you only wrote iver, that's something that's problematic. Aval charvarvar v'amayi makvuim di'idnu bei. But those ailments where the eyes are there, but they just don't function, lo, that would not be a mum. So that's why the Katav Rachmana ish. The Torah wrote ish to tell you not only in a case where the eye is missing, but even if the eye is present but not functional, that's also problematic. V'katav Rachmana ish, if you had the word ish, mishum deloka chazi klau, because he has no vision. Iver is a lack of an eye. Ish iver, which is the chavarvar, and the maimak vuim, is that the eye's there, but it has no function. It's unable to see at all. Aval machsuraita, but if you have a deficit in the eyesight, lo, that would not be problematic. The way Rashi says it is, shechasra marito, aval ro'em miktzat. He is missing his eyesight, but he gets some limited vision. That's how Rashi translates it. Rabbeinu Gershom, on the other hand, says, "Shenifchat kitzat mimarot enav," that he has some impairment in his vision. So, according to Rabbeinu Gershom, from Rashi, it sounds like a serious impairment with only a little bit of vision. From the Rabbeinu Gershom, it sounds like you have pretty good vision. There's just some limitation to that ability. I don't know how much that would be. Right. Yeah. Sounds like it. Katav Rachmana Dak. So that's why I wrote Doc, because Doc says even where there's a problem, where you have this tila in the eye, whether it's a cataract or whatever else it is in the eye, that that causes some deficit in the eyesight, that's what would be problematic. That's because there's some sort of deficit. But if there's just cloudiness in the eye, which means that the function of the eye seems to be fine, there's something wrong with the appearance of the eye. The physical appearance of the eye is cloudy. So there you would think maybe that's not a mum. Katar chmana, tevalul. That's why you have the next mum of tevalul, which is where the white of the eye goes into the pupil, the black of the eye, or vice versa. There's some sort of blending or mixing of the colors or the sections of the eye. Be katar chmana tevalul, if you only had tevalul, mishum demebalbalan. Because there's some sort of distortion in the eye or the appearance of the eye. Aval mishum mashniuta, but if there was some other oddity about them, if it was like what we just discussed before, the placement of the eye, where the eye is located on the face, you would think that's not a problem. Therefore, katav rachmana be'eino. To teach you, even that is an issue. So you have all these different gradations of issues with the eye. The reason you need to write each one of them is because they are successively teaching you about a bit less and less of a problem, which is still a disqualifying factor for the individual. Amarova hilkach kol machmat piyuta, anything that is because of, Rashi says, eno ro'eh, piyuta means that the eye is not fully functioning, doesn't have full vision. Atya me'ish, that comes from the word ish. Because we saw before, ish iver. Iver was where you were missing the eye. Ish was that there was no vision or visibility. Machsoraito, if it was some sort of deficit in the vision, that comes from midak. Mibalbalito, if it's something where there's cloudiness or there's some sort of problem with the eye's appearance, then that's mitavlo. And meshnuyutnita, and anything that is odd about the eyes, that comes from mibe'eno. So all he's doing is he's creating categories of problems and saying these represent these categories. It's not simply these particular items, but anything within these categories. So if you're missing the eyes, that's iver. If there's a lack of vision, that's from the word ish iver. That's what it corresponds to in tumor chavarvar and maimak vuim. if there's a deficit in the vision, according to Rashi, if some vision, according to Rabbeinu Chanan, Gershom, you have just some sort of limitation in your vision, anything with a deficit in vision would be from Dak. Mibal Balita would come from Talvlo, if there's any cloudiness or appearance problems with the eye. And Mashneinuta, anything that's unusual or an oddity with the eye, meaning placement, things that don't impact on the appearance of the eye, don't impact on the functioning of the eye, but simply are an oddity in terms of the way the person looks because of where the eyes are placed or shaped, that comes from Ibeino. Right, Sachi Shemesh was mentioned in the Mishnah. Tani Rav Yosef, Sane Shemesh. Rav Yosef interpreted that, explained it as Sane Shemesh, those that hate the sun. The way the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it is, Tani Rav Yosef, Hainu Sane Shemesh. That Sachi Shemesh is synonymous with Sane Shemesh. He can't look at the sun, or really the way that Rashi says over here, he doesn't like it when the sun's out, because the brightness of the sun or the environment makes it uncomfortable for him to be there. Or the way that Bali Tosafot say it is, V'sachi hu lashon chasuche shemesh. Those are people, shenimnami menu ora shemesh. He always is trying to block the sunlight from himself. He's either shading his eyes, he's blocking the sunlight. In essence, it's a high sensitivity to light, which is the problem over here. That's also a type of mum. Zagdayan, what is this problem of Zagdayan? Mechave Rabuna, Chad Medidan, one of ours, Vechad Medidu, and one of his. Now, from the context of the story, you'll understand what it means. His, Ikpid Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda got upset about the fact that Rabuna used him as the example. So Rav Yehuda was sitting there in front of Rav Huna, and Rav Huna says, one of ours and one of his. One eye like mine, one eye like Rav Yehuda. So the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it is, Hainu, She'enu Achad Bria, one eye is healthy like ours, and then one eye is problematic like his, meaning like Rav Yehuda's eye. That's obviously why Rav Yehuda got upset, that Rav Huna used him as an example of someone who has an oddity in his eye. That's one explanation, or the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it. And Rashi is not clear about what the difference is between the eyes, whether there's only one problematic eye or two problematic eyes. But the Rabbeinu Tam in the Balei Tosafot explains that Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda were both oddities. That is because Rav Yehuda was an extremely large individual, very tall and large individual. And Rav Huna was an extremely small individual. Therefore, Rav Yehuda, in essence, proportionate to its size, had eyes that were extremely large or very big. Rav Huna, who was a smaller individual, had smaller eyes. And therefore, going to Rabbeinu Tam, unlike Rabbeinu Gershom, who says one was normal, one was odd, like Rav Yehuda, he says both eyes are problematic by the Zagdayan, which is one is small like Rav Huna's, and one is large like Rav Yehuda's. And that's what he says here. Mushomachi loya enav nikarot ktanot kokach. Michel Stam Bnei Adam, Rav Huna was much smaller. His eyes are differential, and his eyes being smaller was not as noticeable as that of a normal person's eyes. Aval Michel Rav Yehuda Yunikarot Yagdolot Harbe. Rav Yehuda's eyes were very visibly different because they were so big or so large that they were an obvious oddity. And therefore, he got upset when Rav Huna pointed out him as an example. Va'abagav. Even though neither of these are a mum to be classified as something that would disqualify you from avoda, the Mishnah said that in order to be a problem, you need one that is as big as an egel or one that is as small as a goose. So that's the size differential you need for it to be classified as a mum. And this doesn't meet that standard. Again, back there when we learned it, there's the same machloket as to whether it means both eyes have to be problematic. Only one of the eyes has to be problematic. And over here, it's different because mikol makom ein zeh shaveh bezeroh shel arov. This is a disqualification, not because it's a mum, but because it's eino shaveh bezeroh shel arov. So we discussed yesterday that there are three different gradations of problems. There's a mum, which is a mum in a Torah. There is sheino shaveh bezeroh shel arov, which is it's not normal. It's something that's odd, but it's not a full-fledged mum. And then that's only applicable by human beings. It doesn't apply to animals. And then there's Marat Ayin, which, again, we'll discuss today, which is that third category. So Tosafot is pointing out that this doesn't meet the standard of Mum of the previous Perek, but it does meet the standard Shalosh Shaviv Sarosh Aron, so it affects humans, not animals. And he also is pointing out that he thinks that both eyes were problematic. And Rav Huna felt maybe comfortable saying something about Rav Yehuda, because he was also pointing to himself about his eyes being not normal. And therefore, he didn't feel like he was offending Rav Yehuda when he pointed it to Rav Yehuda because of the fact that he pointed to himself as well as being something of an oddity. So now we have a question on this explanation of Zag Dayan. Shchavna, the mum of Shchavna, or the problem of Shchavna is Shigvinav Shochvim. That is, eyebrows are sitting down or laying down. We saw this before, that they are so long that they reach down onto his eyes, they reach down onto his face. Zagdum. The definition of Zagdum is Echad Shachor Vechad Lavan. One that is black and one that is white. The question is clearly that Zagdum is translated or explained differently. It could be that Echad Shachor Vechad Lavan is a reference to the eyebrows. He has one eyebrow that is black and one eyebrow that is white. And that's the problem over here. And then the stira is the fact that we explain Zagdum before having to do with the sides of the eyes, and the bright is explaining it to do with the nature of the eyebrows. That could be the problem. Or the other possibility is that Achat Shachor Bachat Navan makes it sound like that's the problem here. The problem is that one eye is black, or is blackish, and one eye is whitish, and that's the issue. It has nothing to do with size. So then, that also is a different definition than we gave before, where it says, Tana Kozuga Deloshavi La'adadi Zagdum Korile. Zagdum is not a particular term, but rather a generic term for any two limbs that are supposed to be the same size or same, and they turn out to be different. So here, again, if you're saying, even if you define it as eyebrows, both eyebrows are supposed to be generally the same size, the same color. The fact that they're not is called Zagdum. Again, the word Zagdum comes from the word Zug, means a pair. And the word is made up of Zug, which is a pair, and Dus, from the word Du, which means two. And so therefore, it's any pair of limbs or pair of items that are two. So it's a word that's referencing to a pair of limbs that otherwise should have been identical, but there's some difference between them. That difference could be in size. That difference could be in color. That difference can be in appearance. Any one of those things that are different is called Zagdum. And therefore, the Braita is not a steer to what we're saying. It's just giving a different example of what the definition of Zagdum is. Hatziran, which is another one of these items that was mentioned in our Mishnah, is Enav Trutot Vitziraniyot. So now, I'm just going to be honest over here. The Gemara is extremely difficult in terms of how to parse it. It's not clear here which words belong to which item. Are they part of the definition, or are they a different item? You could say that Atziran are Enav Trutot. As Rashi says over here, and everybody agrees, Trutot mean that they are roundish, agulot. Then Tziraniyot could be a part of that definition, which is Tziran is when the eyes are Trutot Vitziraniyot. And then Trutot Tziraniyot would mean extremely round and being one definition rather than two different definitions. Rashi says Tziraniyot is agulot yotermi Trutot. They're even more roundish than Trutot. It's a more extreme rounding of the eye. So according to Rashi, it seems like you have two different things. You have Tziran, which is Enav Trutot, and then you have another item, which is Tziraniyot. And Tosafot is bothered a little bit by this, which is, why don't you just mention one of them and you would have known the other? And it's a Kal Vachomer. It's a Kal Vachomer. If Trutot are problematic, then certainly Tziraniyot are problematic. And he says the same thing in the next piece of the Gemara, which we're going to say in a second. Then why does it do that? So Tosafot says, maybe the reason is to tell you that none of these are real mumim, they're all problems of Enu Shavev Zarosh Al Aron. So despite the fact that Tziraniyot are a more extreme problem than Trutot, nevertheless, it still doesn't meet the threshold of a mum. It's still only Enu Shavev Zarosh Al Aron. So that's Rashi's explanation, that Trutot is round. Tziraniyot are extremely rounded eyes. Look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, on the other hand, he says it's a reference to two different things, which is Trutot are round eyes, Tziraniyot are shagul oto makom sha'ayin munachbo. It's the eye socket. So he says the difference between Trutot and Tziraniyot is Trutot refers to the eye itself that is rounded, whereas the See, Reniyot refers to the socket itself, which is rounded. It's only interesting because that was the difference between what we said, an animal that has a human eye. What was that difference that we mentioned in the previous parak? Was that the human eye is round. So over here we're saying that rounding is Eino Shaveh B'Shel Rosh Shel Aron. But despite the fact that the eye or the appearance of the eye is round, if you look at people's eyes, they are oblong in shape, meaning that there's a tapering to the right and left of the eye, especially given the eyelids that are there. So rounding of the eye would probably be something where it doesn't have that tapering on the sides. It's very round. And that would be the one issue. The other issue is the socket, which is generally round. But I'm assuming that it means that it's extremely round, or the appearance of the socket is obvious, that there's some sort of rounding there, rather than the way that we have it that makes it look like it's oblong. All right, so then, domot, dofot, and tordot. So it's not clear here, again, how many items you have here, and what is being defined over here. Rashi sees them as being three different items. And that is, domot is somebody who tears a little bit. Dofot is someone who tears more often, meaning from the delef, a drip. And then tordot is someone who is continuously, from the word tarud, is continuously engaged in tearing. So Rashi just sees them as three different degrees of tearing, from the lowest to the highest amount of tearing that the eyes have. That's where Tosafot before again said, just tell me domot and I'll know the other two are problematic. That's where Tosafot says, the chiddush over here is that even though tordot is something extreme, nevertheless, we still classify it as Eino Shaveh Zerosh El Aron and not as being something that is a mum gomor. You look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says that dofot, like Rashi, is yoter mi domot, and then tirdot, is dovot below hefsek, like Rashi, continuously tearing. Then he says, v'ikadamre. Your son will bring an additional explanation. Tordot, she'en yochol atzom einav, elam b'torach gadol. He's unable to close his eyes, except by making a great exertion, or a great effort to close his eyes. That's what it means, tordot. It's a tirda. It's a difficulty. It's a undertaking in order to close your eyes. That's another possibility. And if you look in the Masoret HaShas, he quotes from the Aruch, the same thing that the Rabbeinu Gershom says. Normally the Aruch picks up things like that from the Rabbeinu Gershom. So it's not surprising that he says, Sheinu kol atzum einav ela b'torach. But then he brings Perush Acher, Poteach v'sugir einav ve'einu domeim, that his eyes are continuously fluttering, opening and closing, and they never are at rest, ela b'tirda. He has to forcibly stop them from opening and closing. He has to forcibly stop them from blinking all the time. It's not just a natural blink. It seems like there's a fluttering of the eyelid. So that's another possibility as to what tordot are. Again, there's a possibility that domot, dofot might be one item, which is, that's one problem. And then there's tordot is another problem. Or domot, dofot could be defined by tordot. And according to the Rambam, it's even more extreme, which is that all this is the definition of tziran. Tzir means some sort of liquid that's coming out, and here it's giving you the definition of what that liquid is, and all these are also part of the definition of tzir. You can parse it in all different ways, and that might contribute to the different explanations that we saw over here. Tana, hazavdir, or the other girsa is hazavir, valupin, vatamir. These are all problematic. Zavir is dimazor enei. That his eyes are, Rashi says, mizdarzan enav, which again doesn't give you much definition, but the Shita Mikubetzet in Ot Chavdalid says that Rashi actually had two explanations that are missing from the Rashi. One is, she'en yachol lanuach ela mishototot. He's unable to rest. His eyes are in continuous motion. They're floating all the time. Here it sounds not like just the eyelid, but the eyes themselves are always moving around or fluttering. And then, lishna achrina, the amik upatach kosha'a, that his eyes are deep and open all times, meaning that they never close, they're wide open all the time, or that he doesn't blink on a regular basis. Those are two possible explanations as to what this zavir is. Lupin, dinifishin zifei. The lupin is that his eyelashes are extremely long, unusually long. Tamir, shitamu zifin. And tamir is that his eyelashes are missing. So those are two different problems on the extremes. One is that they're too long, and one is that they are too short. They don't exist. Vahane gabe mumim tani lohu. You brought this as part of the mumim. Vatsnan. Then we see in the previous Mishnah, shinishru, we say enough. If he lost his eyelashes, pasumi pnei marat ayin. It's only a problem of marat ayin. So this goes to the gradation of problems. The previous Mishnah mentioned that missing eyelashes is only a problem of marat ayin. Whereas here, the Gemara is saying that the problem is a mum, not a full-fledged mum, but at least enu shavev is a rosh al aron. So then how do you reconcile that? Lokasha, had the ishtuyer gardume, had the lo ishtar gardume. Depends if there are a little pieces that are left. Gardume is used also by tzitzit. On the tzitzit rip, if you have gardume, you have little pieces of them left, that's called gardumim. Also by the ezol that you use for sprinkling, we also said in the Gemara Menachot, gardume mean the leftovers or the residual that's there. So gardume means that there's some residual of the eyelash that is left. Now which is which, Rashi explains, ishtar gardume shurashim lo abimum. If the roots of the eyelashes are still there, it's not a mum. El mishuma dar maratayin. It's a problem of maratayin. So Rashi sees the explanation as being that if they are completely gone, including the roots or the follicles over there, then that's a mum, and that's enu shavev shel aron. If the follicles are still there, but the eyelashes are gone, that's a problem of marat ayin. And going back to marat ayin, Rashi explained before that marat ayin was something that was ma'us, something that was unappealing, an eyesore to look at, as opposed to the normal definition of marat ayin, which is we're worried about people, what they will think about this situation. There are those that explain marat ayin like in the traditional sense, and that could actually now be explained over here, because we see that an eyelash missing with the follicle out is a problem of a mum. So now when the eyelashes are missing with the follicle still there, it might be marat ayin, which is that it appears like they have the mum of enu shavev shel zero shel aron. That might actually change the definition or make it easier to understand marat ayin in its traditional sense rather than the way the Rashi does in this situation. The Rabbeinu Gershom gives an alternate explanation as the lokasha. The Rabbeinu Gershom says, Tahani demosif tana bara, that which the outside tana, I mean the bright that adds, is ha di shtar gardume, that's which is left, klomar, apagav di nishtar ikaro posel. Says, even though the ikar, the root, is still there, it's pasul. Vahadematznitin, deloy di ishtar mi gudumude kalal. When there's nothing left at all. So, it's very interesting. He says almost what seemingly is the opposite of what Rashi says over here. He's saying that if there are gudumim left, even though there's some ikar left to it, that is pasul. Whereas if they are gone the gamre, then that is considered to be just a problem of maratayim. As opposed to Rashi, who sees that something being left is a positive, here it sounds like from the beginning of Gershom, something being left is actually a negative. If it's all gone, then it's clean. And then it's just a maratayim problem. If there's still little residual items that are there, that already looks funny. That already is enu shavev zaro shel aron. That's seemingly what the Rabbeinu Gershom is saying. Seemingly the opposite of what Rashi explained in terms of lokasha. Right now, next Mishnah. Enav gidolot kishel egel. Avaz. That's what Tosafot quoted before. When you have eye that is as big as a calf's eye, or an eye that is as small as a goose eye, I mean, these are full-fledged mumim, as opposed to what we saw before, which was Enu Shavev Zaro Shel Aron. Gufo gadol me'evarav. His body is disproportionate to his limbs. Okatan me'evarav. Anyway, it means that the proportional size of the body and the limbs is somewhat out of whack. Chodmo gadol me'evarav. His nose is bigger than his standard limbs. Okatan me'evarav, or smaller than his standard limbs. Hatzomeim vatzomeya. Ezehu tzomeya. What is a tzomeya? Kol she'oznov katanot. So his ears are very small. Vetzomeim kol she'oznov domot lisvog. Tzomeim is if his ears are similar to a sponge. The way Rashi explained that is that they are kvatzot. They are shriveled up, ustumot, and blah. That's the way Rashi explains it. The Rambam, on the other hand, in Pesach Mishnayot, says that the spog means that they're large. They're floppy and large. It's the opposite of tzomeya, which are small ears. The tzomeim are larger ears, or floppier ears. Sfato el yona udefet al tachtona. Again, we quoted this in the previous parak. If his upper lip or upper jaw extends over the lower one, al tachtona udefet al yona, or the bottom one extends over the upper one. Those are all problematic. Vishinishru shinav, if his teeth fell out, pasul mipnei maratayin. That's not a mum, that's not even enu shavib is a rosh alaro. That's a problem of marat ayin. Amar Rav, Moshe Rabbeinu eser amotaya. Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 amot tall. Shinemar, how do I know that? Because it says, vayifros et ha'ol al ha'mishkan. He spread the oil on top of the mishkan. Mishkan is a reference to the area of the heichal, the kodesh, and the kodesh, the kodeshim, and the mishkan. That is the part that is surrounded by the krashim, and then has the covers over it. So the covers that go on top, someone had to spread them out. Moshe Rabbeinu did it. Mi persho, who spread it out? Moshe Rabbeinu persho. He's the one who spread it out on top. Uchtiv, eser amot, orech ha'koresh. In order to spread something on top of the mishkan, the krashim are 10 amot tall. So somebody has to be tall enough to place it on top. And so that's what he comes to the conclusion, that Moshe was at least 10 amot tall, otherwise he wouldn't be able to spread the oil on top of the mishkan. Amar le Rav Shimi bar Chiya the Rav. So Rav Shimi bar Chiya says to Rav, we actually saw him in yesterday's daf as well. Rav Shimi bar Chiya is Rav's grandson, so he learned in front of him, and he's many times asked him questions in Shas. Im kein asitu le Moshe Rabbeinu ba'amon. That's true, he made Moshe into ba'amon. Tetzan, gufo gadol me'ev Rav, o katan me'ev Rav. If his body is disproportionate to his limbs, then it is problematic. It's a mum. So over here, we know, and Rashi says it over here, the standard size of an individual is 3 amot. That's the relationship between an ama. An ama is defined as from your elbow until the end of your fingers. So if you take 3 of those, that's the standard height of an individual. So if 3 amot is the standard height, that is a relationship, which means that your ama should relate to your height at 3 times, your height should be 3 times your amah. In this case, if you say Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 amot tall, that means that his height was 10 times the size of his limb. Or in essence, his body was disproportionately big vis-a-vis his limb, his arm. Because he has a ratio of 10 to 1 versus normal people have a ratio of 3 to 1. I'm not going to go into so much detail. We discussed this back in the Gemara in Bava Batra on Daf Tzaditet, where there the Gemara is speaking about the kuchim and heights of individuals. Over there, there's a machlok and Rashi and Tosafot as to whether the standard height of an individual is 3 amot or 4 amot, as to what is included in the 3 amot or 4 amot. Is the 3 amot from your feet until the top of your head? Or is the 3 amot only from the feet until your shoulders? And then according to Tosafot, there's an additional amah for your head that sits above your shoulders. So again, that would get to maybe what the standard height of individuals was back then. It's clear that height has grown over time, and that people in the Middle Ages, at the time of Rashi and Tosafot, were much shorter than they are today. Given all that, both Rashi and Tosafot over here say that the ratio was 3 to 1. Even if it's 4 to 1, you still have a problem that Moshe Rabbeinu is 10 to 1 in his ratio of his limb, his ama, to his height. And that's what Rav Shimi bar Chiya is saying to his grandfather, Rav, you make him into a Baal Mum. Amalei Shimiat, you're the Shimi who's the big Talmud Chacham, you're asking such a question. Bamashel, it's either Keresh or Kodesh, doesn't really matter, it's the same thing. Kamar, meaning that he's not measuring it in Moshe's Amot, he's measuring it in the objective Ama. The Ama of the Kodesh, which is 10 Amot high, equals Moshe's height. That for Moshe might only be 3 Amot in Moshe's Amot. So according to Moshe, his Ama was the equivalent to 3 1/3 Amot of Hekdesh. But that means that it's still for him, proportionately, it's only 3 times. What I'm speaking about are the standard or objective Amma. So there's an objective Amma and a subjective Amma. By definition, Amma is always subjective because of the fact that everybody's arms are different lengths. Very good. So Rashi asks your question. He says, Bahad Amram Bepirke Delel. Wait a minute, didn't we just say in the previous parak that there was in the Bureau of Measurements and Weights, they had there the ruler that taught you what an Amma was? And then they had half an etzba or an etzba above that. But that was based on, it says there, from Moshe Rabbeinu. That means that the Amma that was in the Bureau of Measurements and Weights was Moshe's Amma, which is 3 1/3 times the normal size of an Amma. So Rashi says over there, V'adam ran the pirk of the hell, v'chad yitira al shom Moshe chatzi etzba, labish shom Moshe mamash kamar. It's not really Moshe's Amma. It's not his personal Amma. It's the standard Amma that he put into place. It was the measurement that he determined as to what an amah should be, but it's not his subjective amah. Because if that was the case, then the amah that was there would be 3 1/3 times the normal amah of an individual. So Rashi addresses that question as to what we mentioned before. Right, so the Maharal is bothered by your point, which is, why is Rav Shimi over here taking it so literally? Because when we have these types of Midrashim, it's exactly that. It's Midrash. It doesn't mean that Moshe was physically 10 amot tall. Rather, it's a statement about his spiritual height. About 10 amot, and the Maharal, Kedarko Bakodesh, looks at numbers meaning different things, and 10 amot is a certain amount of shleimut that's associated with Moshe Rabbeinu, and he sees that as being a statement of Ruchaniyut and not a statement of Gashmiyut. Although, based on what the Gemara is saying over here, and the question Rav Shimi Bar Chiya asks, sounds like they're taking it very literally, not as something that is a parable of sorts, because otherwise Rav should have just answered him in that manner and said, I don't mean literally, I meant figuratively that he's 10 amot high. You could try to read that into his answer. He says it's Bamot Kodesh, I'm saying. Bamot Kodesh means that in the Amot of Kedusha, that's what I'm speaking about. I'm not speaking about physical Amot, I'm speaking about spiritual Amot. So you could read it into the words. That's not as simple reading, but it is possible to read it in that way. Chotmo Gadol, or Chotmo Katan, if he has a nose that is larger or smaller than it should be proportionately, Tana to Etzba Ktana. So now Rashi explains this as being what is considered to be an excessive nose or too small a nose. Rashi says it's an Etzba Ktana, it's your pinky. The width of your pinky is an Etzba. So if you measure, if you take the width of your pinky, if the nose extends larger than what a person of a similar size would have had as a nose, it goes more than an Etzba over that, or an Etzba less than that, that's a proportionate mum. So that's how you measure it. The Rambam, on the other hand, says something interesting. He says everybody's nose is proportionate to their pinky size. If you hold your pinky over your nose, from the joint of your pinky to the top of your pinky is the size of your nose. It's just a interesting fact. But that's what he says. It means tatsatana etzbaktana, that the nose has to be proportionate to the pinky size. If it's not proportionate to that, that's already an oddity, or that is a disproportionate nose. Atzimeim vatzimeya. Tana af. Atzimeach. We have a breita. Also the tzimeach. So in the Mishnah we mentioned tzimeim and tzimeach, which are problems with the ears. Then we have a breita that says that also the tzimeach. Lo v'yadei rabbanan my tzimeach. The rabbanan heard the word, they just didn't know what it was. They didn't know how to define it. Again, many times when we speak in the Bavli, you're speaking about Hebrew words that are coming from Mishnaic or Tanaic works that were in Eretz Yisrael, and they're trying to translate that in Bavel into what they know. So some of the Hebrew words they know, some of them they don't, and they're trying to figure out what it means. Shemulo Hautaya, they heard this merchant, Davakamar, Mandaboy Tzimeach, but does somebody want Tzimeach? Beishtakach, Gedaya Chaziza. And then they saw that it was speaking about a goat who has very long ears, that they are floppy and they're going down. So from his advertising, they realized that the word Tzimeach was speaking about the size of the ears, or floppy ears, like that of a gedi, like that of a goat. Amar Rav Chista, Eis Shein La Karnayim, a goat that doesn't have horns, even though it normally does, V'Rachel Sheish La Karnayim, or a ewe that does have horns, even though they don't normally have, K'sherim L'Gabei Mizbeach. It's not only not a mum, it's not even a disqualifying factor for a korban. Tanya Nabi Ochi, we have a braita that supports that understanding. Yesh Dvarim Shein Kemumim, Veinam Kemumim. There's certain things that you would have assumed are mumim, but they're not mumim. V'shochatim aleihem b'mikdash. Not only are they not mumim, they're also qualified to be korbanot in the mikdash. Avelo b'midina. But it's not a sufficient reason or a mum to shecht in the midina. In essence, it's nothing. We don't worry about it at all. What is that? Ve'elohim. Eish shein lo karnayim, a goat that doesn't have horns. Rachel sheish lo karnayim, or you that does have horns. Ve'atzimeach, v'atzimeim, v'atzomeya. These are the three items that we mentioned before, which in our Mishnah are disqualifying. At least two of them in our Mishnah are disqualifying, and one of them in the Braita, that was a disqualifying factor. All of those are problems of Enu Shaveb Zarosh El Aron. They're not disqualifying factors by Behema. That's why they're only found in this Perek, not found in the previous Perek. And all of these items, even though they would be a Mum Ba'adam and disqualify him from the Avoda, it will not disqualify the animal from going on the Mizbeach. So Amar Rav Chista, Amar Meimar, Natlu Karnotav, V'Zachrutan Imahen, Psula, V'Ein Podim Aleihem. Natlu Talfayim, V'Zachrutan Imahem, Psulim, V'Niftim Aleihem. Chista is telling us from a Meimar, if the horns are taken off with a Zachrut. Zachrut here means that a difference between what's called a shofar and what's called a keren, truthfully, is the difference between what the Gemara is speaking about over here, which is that a shofar is hollow because it's the outer part of the horn. There's a bone inside of it, and you take off the what is on the outside. A keren is actually where the actual horn itself is the bone that's extending. So what they're describing over here is when you pull off the horn with zachutan, with the etzem that's underneath it. That's when you take it out. If you do that, that's psula. That's a disqualifying factor. Vein podim aleim. And you cannot use that to redeem them. I mean, it's a sufficient mum to disqualify them. It's not a sufficient mum to say that you can then eat the bechor outside of the mikdash, or that you can redeem the kodoshim. The other hand, talfayim, when it comes to the hooves, you have the same thing. The hooves are the outer piece. There's a bone that sits under the hoof itself. So if you took off the hooves, vizachutan, and the bone that sits underneath it, then those are both psulim. That is a disqualifying factor. Viniftim aleim. And it's a more significant mum to the point where now you could redeem the animal, or you could eat the bechor outside the mikdash from such a mum. Now the Gemara says, Meitevei, natlu karnayim vitalfayim vizachutanim aleim. If the horns and the hooves were taken off with the bone, psulim, viniftim aleim. They are pasul, and you can redeem them. So now here it sounds like, as opposed to what Christa said, where there's a difference between the horns and the hooves, over here it puts them together and says they both have the same din, which is that it's a disqualifying mum and a sufficient mum to shef the animal on. It says, lo kasha, hadid akar it akure, hada igam igume. Depends on what you did. As Rashi notes over here, if you are akar, which is that you actually uprooted the bone, not only did you take the horn off, you took out the bone itself with it, and that bone left a hole in the head because you took out the root of the bone. That is something that's a serious mum. Rav Chista, on the other hand, is speaking about igume gigum, which means that you sliced it off, that you cut it at some point, but you left the base or the root of the bone in place. You left a stump at the top that was in place. That's the case where it is pasul, but not enough to redeem it. And that's how we can reconcile between the two. Where it says, Viramini, is that really true? Parash karnea vitalfash horim, a paraduma, which has either hooves or horns that are black, and therefore it's going to ruin it from being a paraduma, you go, slice them off. So if you're going to slice them off, sounds like that is not something that you can't shift the animal on, but not even something that disqualifies the animal, because if you put a mum in the paraduma, it wouldn't be usable anymore. So tagamazirei milavei zichrut. It's only if you cut the horn above the internal bone. So you actually have to have three different categories. You have, if you cut the bone, the same is true by the hooves. If you cut them not where the underlying bone is, that's not even a mum. That is totally fine. If you cut them with the bone, that's already something that for horns is disqualifying. For hooves, it's disqualifying and enough to redeem it on. If you then uproot the actual bone underneath and take it out completely, that's not only disqualifying, but also good enough to shef the animal, be put the animal on. The deim shochvim kashel isha, if he has large breasts like that of a woman, you know, they're sitting, they're oversized. Kriso tzava, he has this swollen belly. Tiburo yotze, he has, whether it's his belly or his belly button that's extending out. Nichpe, he has dropsy or epilepsy. Afilu achat yamim. Even though it happens, the way the Rambam explains that, meaning even though it happens at distant intervals, it's not something that happens on a regular basis. The way the Rashi and the Rabbeinu Gershom explain it is, shetavol bezman kavua. Even though it's at a fixed time, he knows when he's going to have the epileptic fit so he can avoid it, even though that doesn't help you out. The mere fact that you have epilepsy is the problem. And even if it can be controlled, quote unquote, we don't view it as being a mum over. We don't view it as being something that, well, when he doesn't have it, it's okay, because it could happen at any moment. And even though he knows when it'll happen, or even though it happens very rarely, it's still a problem or a mum. Ruach kitzara ba'alav. Over here, it's hard to know what that is. Rashi says ruach kitzara is a ruach shev, that he is possessed by a demon. Others say ruach kitzara means his shortness of breath, meaning that he has some problem with in terms of his ability to do things or the ability to exert himself. Hameushban ubal gever. We'll see it in the Gemara, but Rashi already tells you. Mushban is that if his testicles are extremely large, Ubal gever is that if his member is extremely large. Amar Rabbi Abba b'rei Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, mashtinin mayim bifnei rabim, you're allowed to urinate in public. Vein shotim mayim bifnei rabim. On the other hand, you're not allowed to drink water in public. Tanya Rabbi Yochi, we have a braita that supports that contention. Mashtinin mayim bifnei rabim, you can urinate in public. Vein shotim mayim bifnei rabim, and you can't drink water in public. Rashi says over here, the reason you can't drink water in public is because it's a derech v'tamut chacham liot tzanua. You have to be a person that is modest, proper, and therefore it's inappropriate to eat and drink in front of the public. We have other statements of the Gemara that eating while you're walking around in public is so that's something that is considered to be inappropriate or unbecoming type of behavior. Rashi seems to be indicating it's akin to that. They don't just drink in front of other people. On the other hand, that urinating in front of people is because of the danger associated with that. They were willing to suspend its tzniut. We'll discuss that in 1 second, because of the dangers that involve. Tosafot is a little bit circumspect about Rashi's explanation, because we find examples of Talmidei Chachamim drinking in public. And therefore, why is that an issue? So Tosafot says, context is important. If it's in the context of a se'uda, or in the context of people eating, then the Talmud Chacham eating in public or drinking in public is not a problem, because that's what everybody's doing. Whereas drinking in public where nobody else is drinking or nobody else is involved with the food matters, that would be something that's not considered to be tzanua. That's how Tosafot explains this. The Rabbeinu Tam offers a third explanation, which is, even though people take upon themselves to be extra tzanua, extra modest in their behavior, so some people had this modesty thing that they would not drink in public. So what the Gemara is saying is, even for those people that don't drink in public, they're allowed to urinate in public. So it's not telling you that drinking in public is a problem, or that that's a sign of modesty for a Talmid Chacham. Rather, it's saying that those people that do keep that level of modesty, they shouldn't do that with regards to urinating, and they should urinate in public. The reason being, the Gemara is going to explain now, it was an individual, he wanted to urinate, and he held it in. And then his stomach burst, the holding in of the urine caused some sort of rupture in the individual. Shmuel needed to urinate to relieve himself on the Shabbat of the Regel, which either that means the Shabbat of the Regel itself, more likely the way Rashi describes it over here was 30 days before the Chag, when he gave the drosha to start the Sholim Adorshim Ilkot HaChag. So it's a big gathering, lots of people, and now he's giving the shir and he needs to urinate. What's he going to do? Now they held up for him a cloak, and he took care of himself. He relieved himself on the spot. After the Kameh Dabua, Shmuel went back to his father to tell his father what they did for him, that they held up the cloak and that he urinated. I'll give you 400 zuz, which is a significant sum of money. You should go back and retract what you said. The way Rashi says it, drosh shasur lamtim. You have to go back and doresh in public that what you did was wrong. You have that possibility because of your stature, because people would take care of you. You have the wherewithal to take care of this matter in such a manner. But other people that, who don't have that possibility, they should be in danger and they should just hold it in. That's improper. So Rashi says he was paying him to go back and retract what he did, but only retract it through a drasha. Rabbeinu Gershom says it in a much more interesting way. He says that I'm going to pay you 400 zuz. Klomar shetamod adavar al hilchato. Go fix what you did wrong. Shetashtin lifnehem begaloi. That you should go back and urinate in front of them without a glima there. And the explanation is that you who wear a glima, because you're a Talmud Chacham, you're someone who wears a cloak, you had the capacity to do that or wherewithal to do that. Other people don't have a cloak that they can take off and hold up. So then what are they going to do? But over here, then the demand was that he actually go back and urinate and demonstrate in public that there's no problem with doing such. And it's actually proper to urinate in public, even if you don't have the tzniut, even if you don't have the glima to do it. So Rashi sees it as it being a drasha, say over the halacha in this manner so that people understand what the halacha is. Whereas the Rabbeinu Gershom says he wants him to actually demonstrate that that's a halacha. 400 zuz is actually a number that is mentioned a number of times in the Gemara. For instance, the incident where there was a woman going through the shuk who was wearing red clothing, which was not considered to be tzanua, and one of the Amoraim came and ripped it off because he thought she was Jewish. Turned out she wasn't a Jewish woman, and the authorities penalized him for that, or fined him for that, and they fined him 400 zuz. 400 zuz was a lot of money, but was also a penalty for embarrassing someone in public. So what Rav Shmuel's father was saying to him was, I'll pay you the 400 zuz for you to be embarrassed in public, but you should go and do it, because then at least you'll demonstrate that the halacha is that way. Marba Ravashi, Itzrich Aguda Gamla. He suddenly had an urge to go to the bathroom. He couldn't hold it in anymore. And he was over the bridge, or he was over some sort of crossing or intersection. Ashtin. So he relieved himself right there on the spot. Amrulei Chamatach Ka'atya. Your mother-in-law is coming. So you're in the middle of urinating and your mother-in-law is coming. That would be, they consider to be something that was inappropriate or something that you wouldn't want your mother-in-law to see it. Amrulei Ba'utna. He says back to them, even if she was here and her ear was here, I would do it into her ear. That's the way Rashi explains it. Others explain it simply that if it was, she was an earshot, I would still do it. Or it's just an exaggeration. It doesn't really matter because this is a sakana, and therefore I need to relieve myself with irrespective of whether she's here or not here. But typically, Mishum Alkor, who says that the problem here is the fact that you did not urinate. Maybe the problem here, why that person in that incident before had a rupture, is not because they needed to urinate, but rather because they drank water or they drank the alakot. Now, the usual translation of alaka is a leech. So maybe there's some sort of problem for what the person drank or consumed rather than holding back their urine. How do you know that that's the case? So the Gemara says, bishotate. He was dripping, meaning that the person was trying to urinate and he was unable to urinate properly afterwards because of the holding in of the urination. So afterwards, when he goes to urinate, it just drips out. It doesn't come out in a flow. So that's an indication that the problem was caused because of the holding back of the urine. Tarabanan, Shnei Nikavim Yesh Bo Ba'adam. There are two called pipes, holes in an Adam. Echad Motzi Sheten, Vechad Motzi Shechvadzera. One of them is the urinary tract, and one of them is the reproductive tract. Physiology over here is not so clear what they're speaking about or exactly what's going on. In a woman, it is true that you have two different or separate tracts. For a man, that's not the case. It's one tract, both for the reproductive and the urinary system. Based on the Gemara's understanding, there was only like a garlic peel's difference between them. Shashadam nitzrach. A person needs to urinate or to relieve themselves. Im nikvo zelatovzeh. If they puncture or rupture into each other, nimzakar. That's going to make them impotent. So the concept that they're espousing over here and why they think there's danger in holding back from the urine is that holding back from urinating causes a rupture, a mixing between the reproductive and urinary tract. And because of that, the person there is no longer able to reproduce. So there's a significant danger in holding back. And for that reason, you're allowed to relieve yourself in these situations, even in public, even in front of others. Amesh Lakish, my dichtiv. What's meant by the pasuk? When is it going to be that you have nobody who's impotent? When you act like your animals. And just like the animals urinate in public or relieve themselves whenever they need to, if you do the same, then you won't be akar. Then you won't have this problem of being impotent. You will not be short of talmidim. Vakara, shalotve tfilatcha, akura lifnei hamakom. That your tfilah will not be rejected or come back empty from a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Eimatai. When is that true? Bizman shata, misim atzmacha kebeima. When you make yourself like an animal. Rashi over here says that the tfilah that we're speaking about here is when you're praying for children. When you're praying for offspring. So your contribution to the factor is that you act like a beima. That you urinate on time, and that you don't cause yourself to become impotent, so that's your contribution. So that you won't come back empty-handed for that tefillah, you act like a behema. That's one way to explain it. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot over here see the tefillah as being more generic. It says, v'nira l'chol tefillah kamar. It's not specific about this tefillah. The idea here also of, mishe etzmo, simat smoke behema, doesn't mean that he's urinating, like they said the subject before. He's saying that smoking behema means that a person that is humble, that says and that doesn't have airs about themselves, they are Adamu behema toshia Hashem. That when an Adam is mesim atzmo kebehema, Hashem is moshia oto. That concept, or that idea is what's being conveyed over here. So then, according to Rashi, it's really a continuation of our Gemara from before. According to the Bali Tosafot, it's because it's a drusha on the same pasuk that we have it in a similar type of drusha with regards to behema, but it's not topically relevant, which has nothing to do with urinating. It has to do with tefillah in general and the way that you approach tefillah, that you should come to tefillah like a behema. And then, obviously, the first piece is about talmidim. You should not have talmidim. So then, if I look at it from that and add together what you have from Rashi, that means that how is a person not barren? How is a person not impotent? Is if they produce students and they produce offspring, which is that's how a person becomes eternal. A person is, by definition, a basar v'dam, has a limited lifespan, and therefore they're not going to make it past whatever their lifespan is. How do I extend that? How do I become not an akar, not an akara? Is if I raise children and I have talmidim, I have students. And maybe that's also mishum, that if you make yourself like a behema is interested or instinctively knows that it has to maintain the species. So similarly over here, if you act like a behema, I mean that you have to maintain the way that you maintain yourself, or you convey your misora forward, is to have talmidim and to have children. So that's also an aspect of what's being said here. And the Marsha adds that it is the growth of the individual on the spiritual side, which is the Talmidim or the Inyanei Torah, and then Tefillah that's mentioned here. So the physical offspring were mentioned in the Psukim before, where it says, Uberech Bibit Necha. So over here, the Psukim are referencing not to physical offspring, but to spiritual offspring, referencing to Limanot Torah and Tefillah. Alright. Amar HaPapa. Lo Yishtin Adam Maim, Lo Agabei Kli Cheres, Velo HaMakom Kasha. You're not allowed to do or urinate into a urinal that's made of pottery, and you shouldn't do it onto ground that is hard. Rashi over here explains that it's not necessarily because it's pottery, but it's because it's going into a urinal that it's a problem, and eventually the urinal you're going to have to dump out. And when you end up dumping it out, you're going to end up dumping it out into the river. Or if you urinate in a place where the earth is not absorptive, then the urine is going to flow down to the river. What's the problem with the urine going into the river? You would have thought the problem is that then you're poisoning the drinking water, which was an extreme problem in their days. They used to use the river both for relieving themselves and drinking water, and of course it caused huge problems. But here the Gemara says it's a problem because Amarav had a Midori de Bavel, Mahadre Maile Inetam. That the Midori de Bavel, those areas of Bavel where the rivers are, they are the water source for Inetam. For the spring of Enei Tam, which supplied water to the Beit HaMikdash, was higher than the Beit HaMikdash, and brought the aqueduct system from Enei Tam to Har HaBayit to supply water to Har HaBayit. Rashi over here says, so the reason you can't urinate on a hard location or a Kli Cheres is because the water is going to get dumped into the descending places, the Midronim of Bavel, and those Midronim of Bavel will then bring water back to the Mikdash, which is going to be ruined to the water. You're spoiling the water quality. It's going to be brought into the Beit HaMikdash. It's interesting. Others mention the issue of Nahar Prat, that it's the Euphrates River, that Euphrates River, as Tosafot says, supplies water to all the water sources in the world. And so therefore, if the urine or all this stuff's going to the Euphrates, that's supplying the water back to Eretz Yisrael. Tosafot says something interesting. Tosafot obviously did not visit these areas. He had no idea about the locations, about what the topography was like. And Tosafot says, "Bashalti lechad me'eretz Yisrael." I asked someone from Eretz Yisrael, "Farmeli sheyorid me'eretz Yisrael leBavel." That it's just the opposite. The waters of Eretz Yisrael go to Bavel. And he says that's true. Also, we're going to see later on in the Gemara that when it rains in Eretz Yisrael, that's a siman bracha for the Euphrates in Bavel, because the waters of Eretz Yisrael, when it rains in Eretz Yisrael, the rivers in Bavel swell. Now that makes more sense than the other way around. Bavel is a lower-lying land than Eretz Yisrael. So if you're talking about flow of water, it would make more sense that the water flows from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. But Tosafot says, we asked somebody and they told us it doesn't work like that. And Tosafot brings evidence to the fact that the water seems to flow from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. And he says, it's a dochak to say that when the rivers swell so much, that the water starts to flow backwards and actually flows the other way back to Eretz Yisrael. Tosafot leaves it as an unresolved issue. Rashi in other places in Shas mentions that it was an underground water system that took it back. It wasn't the waters of the rivers, but the water table that actually took the water from Bavel back to Eretz Yisrael. Obviously, he's trying to address or deal with this issue, but it's interesting the correlation between the two and which direction the water flowed. But that means that this din is uniquely associated with Bavel. It's not true of other areas. Tosafot already notes that. Even though the Euphrates supplies water to other places as well, that doesn't matter. It's only about Bavel that we're worried about. And number two is it's only in areas where the urine is going to go into the rivers. If it's an area where the urine will be absorbed in place, it would not be problematic. So those are two qualifications of the din that's being mentioned in the Gemara here. Amar Abaye, Hayitata lo tukum anpe yunuka agisa leitlanba. A woman should not urinate facing a child, but if she does it on the side, it's okay. So this has to do with things that we're going to get to in the Gemara Nidah, but when it comes to a woman's urinating, she doesn't really need to expose herself at all because of the way that she urinates. A man, when he urinates, by definition, has to expose himself in order to be able to urinate. So therefore, there are much bigger issues of tzniut by a man in terms of urinating. For a woman, she could urinate and not expose herself. So even though there's a child sitting right there, if she urinated right in front of the child not necessarily seeing her erva. Nevertheless, it's not tzniut. So if you're going to do it, you should turn away and not do it facing the child because of tzniut, not because of exposure to erva. Tanya, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Amuda chuzer mevi adam lidei hadrokon. Silan chuzer mevi adam lidei yarakon. So here you're talking about holding back, relieving oneself. So if an individual holds back defecating, that's going to cause chole meayim. That's going to cause a stomach ailment. Silon, someone holding back from urinating, that causes yarakon, which is some sort of jaundice. Amar Rava bar Ravuna Amar Rav Katin Amar Reish Lakish Dam Raba, person who has a lot of blood, Shkin Raba, causes Shkin to appear. So Dam Raba means that a person is not bloodletting on a regular basis, so he has a lot of blood. Obviously in their day they believed bloodletting was a medically efficacious thing to do. And if a person is very full of blood, that causes Shkin. Shichvat Zer Raba, person has a lot of semen, Sarat Rabah, that causes leprosy or nigaim. Soa Rabah, person has a lot to defecate, then they have a lot of problems with the hadroken. Miraglaim Rabin, if a person has a lot to urinate, Yarakon Rabah, then he has a problem with jaundice. What's interesting here, I think, is that the Gemara, I think, is correlating between colors and the ailment. Which is, just like, take for example, Shechvat Zera. Shechvat Zera, which is white, the Gemara says if someone has too much Shechvat Zera, then it manifests itself in Sarat. It appears in Sarat, which is white. Then you have, for instance, the Dam Raba. If you have a lot of blood, which is reddish, then you get the Shkin, which are these boils, blisters that are reddish rashes that appear on the body of the individual. The urine, which is yellowish, that causes Yerakon, that causes the jaundice or the yellowing of the individual. So it seems to me that there's some sort of correlation between the two of them. Rashi points out with the Shechvat Zera, that's only true if it's person's married. If it's a married individual, then they should be together with their wife in order not to have too much Shechvat Zera build up. But obviously, without a wife, this isn't an issue or this isn't something where it becomes a problem. The other thing is that the latter statements seem to indicate that it's a problem just if you have a lot of it, whereas the first statement that we had was only when you withheld from defecating or you withheld from urinating, might be that they're correlated. When you don't urinate, then you build up a lot of urine, or if you don't defecate, then you build up a lot of feces. So maybe they are correlated, but just some notes about what we just read. All right. Ruach Katsrit Baalav. If a Ruach Katsrit comes upon him, my Nihu, what is this? Tana Ruach Ben Nefelim Baalav. It's a Ruach of Ben Nefelim. Rashi says over here that the Ben Nefelim is a shade. That's what Rashi described in the Mishnah, that this Ruach Katsrit is a demon spirit has entered into the individual. So Rashi says over here that it is a Ruach Shtut that enters the individual, they shade ze Ben Nefelim. Based on this shade, this demon called the Ben Nefelim, you can see in Rashi that he had what seems like a slightly different girsa of Nalat, that maybe the Ruach Katsrit might be separate from what is being described afterwards, which is that there's an alternate girsa over here, and I think you can see it in the Shita Mekubetzet, who lets eat by a lot, my nehu? Nala. And that's the answer, like Rashi says. Then, Tana, Ruach ben Nefilim, Baalav. That's a separate statement or a separate problem. And in that way, the answer to the question about what Ruach Kitzarit is Nala, which according to Rashi is a Ruach Shtut. And then afterwards, the times bring a separate problem, which is the Shade of Ben Nefilim, which is another demon spirit, which the Rabbeinu Gershom of Ir explains is Ruach Shida Shigaon. So as opposed to Nala, which is a Ruach Shtut, the Ruach Ben Nefilim is a Ruach Shigaon. So both of those demon spirits are problematic according to this. It's not one item, but rather two different items, as opposed to the Girsa that we have. So it's not clear here whether the way we have an argument, the Ruach Katsrit is being explained by the Ruach Ben Nefilim. On the other hand, the way it seems that Rashi had the Girsa, and the way that Shita Mekubetzet brings the Girsa, the explanation of Ruach Katsrit is Nala. And then there's a separate issue, which is Ben Nefilim, which is a separate problem or a separate type of demon spirit that causes a problem for the individual. Hamushban v'abal geber. Tana mishuvan bebeitzim. Mishuvan is a reference to the testicles. Ubal geber begid is a reference to the member. Tana mishuvan zakayan. Hagarvatan zebalkik. And gayan bebeitzim. The kayan is a problem in the testicles. Garvata is begid, is a problem with the member. So it seems to me these are other words. They're looking for the definition in Aramaic, or they're looking for the explanation of these ailments. Va'ad kama. How big does it have to be in order to be an oddity that is a problem? So mechavir Rav Yehuda ad rekuva, until the joint. So it seems to be that he's pointing to the knee, and he's saying that if the member reaches the knee, that's oversized, and that's problematic. Tanya Rav Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer ad rekuva pasul. If it reaches until the knee, it's pasul. The malam in rekuva kasher. If it's above the knee, then it's kasher. Igadamre ad rekuva kasher. Till the knee is kasher. The matam in rekuva pasul. Below the knee is pasul. The nafkamina between the two lishonot is the knee itself. Whether the knee itself is pasul or kasher, everybody agrees below the knee is pasul, above the knee is kasher. Question is the knee itself, but that's giving you a sense of size that has to be in order to be an oddity, which obviously would be extremely big. Ein lo beitzim, o ein lo elo beitzachat. He doesn't have testicles, only has one testicle. Harizah meroach asheich, hamur betorah. That is what's mentioned in the Torah as one of the mumim of an Adam, which we read before, o gibein, o dak, o tevalo beino, o garav, o yolefet, o meroach asheich. That's the definition of it. Rabbi Shmuel Omer, kol sheni mocho ashkav. That's not the definition of meroach asheich. Rather, it's only when they are crushed. The testicles are completely crushed. Gibe Omer, kol sheruach beashkav. Only if there is ruach, meaning there's swelling in his testicles. It's when his appearance is dark. The way Rashi says that he has a blackened appearance. So it seems to be that Rabbi Chanina ben Antigonus argues fundamentally on the definition of what meruach hasheich is, and that he thinks that it means something totally different than everybody else in the Mishnah. There are those that say that he's trying to define what was said before by Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva. The appearance that we're talking about here of nemochu hashkav or ruach hashkav is when they appear darkened or blackened, and he might be defining that rather than giving a totally new opinion. And again here, like we said before, the Rambam said it in the previous Mishnayot over here as well, the Tanaim don't disagree that all these things are mumim. The only thing they disagree about is what is the meruach hasheich that is found in the Torah. Right? Kashale the Rabbi Shmuel. If Rabbi Shmuel was bothered by the Tanakama's explanation that missing a testicle or testicles is a problem, because then the pasuk should have said chasar asheich, missing the testicles. Tani shenimruchu ashkav. So therefore, he said that it meant meroach is from the word meruach, to spread or to flatten out, which means to crush it. Kashalei Rabbi Kiva. Rabbi Kiva doesn't explain it that way. Hai me meruach asheich mibayle. According to you, it should be the shortest of the word. It's not ruach, but mimareach. And therefore, the word in the pasuk should not have been meroach ashkech, but rather mimorach ashkech, because the mem is part of the shorish of the word, not a participle that's leading into the word. So then, tani, so therefore, Rabbi Akiva believes that it's hasheruach bashkav. He thinks meroach ashkech is from the shorish ruach, and therefore it means swelling or air that's inside there. Kashli Rabbi Chanina ben Antigonus. Rabbi Chanina ben Antigonus didn't like Rabbi Akiva's explanation, because I ruach hashech mi baile.
then you should drop the mem from it completely, and it should say, Ruach HaSheikh, according to the way that you're explaining it. So Tani, Shemar Av Chashuchim. Therefore, he believed that the explanation here is Maruach HaSheikh, Kashabar, Gorin, Umotzifim, Dorshim. That you can take away, you can add on, and you can be Doresh. You look in Rashi's explanation over here, he says that the way that he built this up was he took Meruach HaSheikh, he took the Aleph from the HaSheikh and put it at the end of the Meruach, and he took the Chet from the Meruach and attached it to the HaSheikh. By flipping those around, then you get the words Miro'o HaSheikh. His appearance is darkened. His appearance is black. And that's the explanation of his or view or why he thinks that the Meruach HaSheikh is a reference to the complexion of the individual rather than to the testicles of the individual. So the argument here is, what is the shorish of the word Meruach? Mer says, Hainu Kushi. That's the problem of Kushi, which is mentioned explicitly in the Mishnayot coming up. So why do you need Meruach HaSheikh to be mentioned over here by Rabbi Chanina ben Antigonus if it's mentioned explicitly in the Mishnayot later on? Mer says, Rabbi Chanina ben Antigonus, Lotani Kushi, he doesn't have that in his Mishnah upcoming, and therefore for him, this is the mention of it, not that later on. Now, it seems to me here that the problem here with the dark complexion is not the dark complexion inherently. It's someone who normally does not have a dark complexion, and then they look black or they look darkened, which is an indication of something being wrong or there's something odd about the individual, and that's why it's a disqualifying factor. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah at the bottom of Mem Daled Amud Bet.